The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, we have a bumper 30 minutes of technological spills and thrills, including the reaction from governments and consumers around the world to the announcement that Twitter is to allow censorship on a country-by-country basis. We're also looking at the rumors that Facebook is about to float on the U.S. stock market. What does a web service need to demonstrate that it's worthy of this step? And has Mark Zuckerberg's global social network proven itself? We're looking at the fallout in Europe for copyright and ownership laws in the wake of the resignation of the European Parliament's anti-counterfeiting trade agreements rapporteur, MEP Kadir Araf. And in the second half of the podcast, we're discussing connected TV, what it is, why it is, and what we can expect as a new fleet of televisions are nailed to the walls of our living rooms. In the studio, I'm joined by Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor. Charles, how are you?
I'm thriving.
Is that because you've had those weird LED things in your ears?
No, you've got those.
I tell you what, I've got complete insomnia. I can't sleep.
I'm not sure if that's meant to be a side effect. What about the SAD? How's that going?
I don't know. I'm very happy. But then again, I was happy before, so I can't really comment on the effectiveness. You can't use me as your case study of one, Charles. But no, I have to say, I did notice almost immediately the first night, even though I'd done my 12 minutes, you know, here in the studio that morning, I was up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I couldn't sleep. And I've had awful sleeps for the past week.
Well, they do say that it has an effect on jet lag, but I don't know if they meant that it actually gives you jet lag.
I now have jet lag. Well, I'm tired, but I'm happy. So it's a jam-packed program. Hold tight and keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. It's the definitive growing up experience in every young startup's business life cycle, the initial public offering, or IPO. During the last tech bubble, vaporware companies were floating on the fumes of their own hot air and making millions. This time around, services have had to spend more time proving themselves and their concrete worth before leveling up to take to the stormy stock market seas. This week, it's anticipated that Facebook, the Goliath of social networks founded in 2004, which now has more than 800 million global users and a robust business model, will finally sell its first piece of stock to the public. Does this indicate a new adult stage in the development of Web 2.0? Charles, the Facebook IPO, when is it expected to happen?
Well, they're expected to file their S-1, which is the formal document that you have to give to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission any day now. As we're speaking, it hasn't yet happened, I don't think. But it's actually required that you have to start giving your quarterly results. You have to start filing financial information with the SEC, whether or not you float, as soon as you pass a certain number of stockholders. Facebook has passed this number, and so it is obliged to do this. And given that it's got to start giving out its numbers, it might as well file for an IPO as well and get some cash while it's doing it.
What does a company have to do in order to reach the threshold at which point it is allowed to float on the stock market?
Really, you just have to get underwriters who are prepared to put money behind the stock if people in the stock market won't buy it. So the whole process is that you as a company do what's in effect usually is a roadshow, and you go around talking to potential investors, merchant banks, and the underwriters, which is often the merchant banks as well, saying, look, here we are. We're a great company. Look at our fantastically robust financial position that we're in. Look at the money that we make. Therefore, why don't you be one of the people who helps sell our shares? You get some of the money. You get some of the underwriting fees for doing it. We get a pile of cash. Everyone's happy. So, for example, companies like LinkedIn, which has a pretty robust financial model. They're not the biggest company in the world, but that's okay. They can still sell stock and get there. Companies like Groupon did much the same, but there are bigger questions over Groupon and whether what it counts as revenues really are revenues, or are they revenues that accrue to Groupon, or are they revenues that accrue to the merchants who are doing things with Groupon. So there's, you know, their stock has been something of an anchor, whereas the LinkedIn stock has sort of bobbled along. With Facebook, you have what looks like a pretty robust financial model. Their ad model lets people target particular demographics, target particular areas. You can, for example, register to be told if you know, if you're selling bridal stuff, if someone changes their status to engaged, which I understand happens within, you know, women tend to do within an hour or so of actually having the proposal given to them. Then, you know, if you're selling bridal stuff, then you can ask Facebook to tell you about it.
Sorry, my inner cynic just really emerged there. You bring up an interesting point there, Charles. Facebook's model is very much about following what it is that we do and accruing our data. Will an IPO indicate or portend potentially more fierce approaches to monetizing our data?
I think that once they have an IPO, once they have the cash that accrues, and by the way, it's worth saying that if people are, you know, people are saying, "Wow, Facebook will be a $100 billion company," you know, depending how its stock prices the stock, that doesn't mean that Mark Zuckerberg is going to go home and fill his mattress with $100 billion.
Well, then we know where to go to get $100 million.
What it actually means is that the total issued share capital of Facebook would be worth $100 billion. But they might not sell all those shares on the stock market at once. They might keep a number of them back. In fact, they'll have to keep some back because there'll be employee stock options and so on. So that's more about, you know, the potential value of the company. It's not actually about how much cash Facebook will pull in. And, you know, if it then sells some more of the stock on the market, it'll get more cash. But anyway, it'll get a big tranche of cash. Will it be more aggressive in how it looks for us? I suspect that to begin with, they'll go fairly easy, actually, because they'll just be looking to get organic growth from expanding into new countries, getting more people in countries. And we might have to watch to see how aggressively it does start using data and whether it does start, especially as it competes more closely with Google, as it's watched more closely in comparison to Google, you know, what it's doing with data.
How does this affect the business, the behind the scenes? I mean, you look at a service that's awfully popular, like Twitter, and it's, people are talking about how it doesn't yet have a business model, and, you know, the idea of it floating seems a really, really far away. How will this level up, or how will this force Facebook to be more business-like, or will it just will they just take over?
Well, the first thing that happens is that lots of people inside the company get rich. You know, suddenly they're all millionaires. You know, this happened at Google in 2004. After having slogged through the startup years, you know, a lot of them crossed the finish line in August 2004. Suddenly they were millionaires, and a lot of them said, "Actually, I don't need to be here. I can go and do something else." And, you know, they took their foot off the accelerator. You know, they just basically said, "Okay, sayonara, Google. You know, this, it's been nice. Now I'm rich. Now I'm going to go look at other things." A lot of others, you know, Larry Page, Sergey Brin, Marissa Mayer, stayed within Google, and, you know, they're still pushing the company ahead now. What it really does do is it means the company has to be a lot stricter about thinking about quarterly filings, thinking about how do we improve our figures for the next quarter, because that's what Wall Street tends to want. You know, even though the external share price doesn't actually affect the money inside the company, it affects the perception of the company, and it affects how the company is seen to be performing. And that's, you know, it's a sort of a circle where the company sees what Wall Street thinks of it, and Wall Street sees what the company is thinking about what it thinks of it. And there's a sort of, you know, a reflective effect. So if the company is thought to be doing well, then things tend to cruise along. But if the company stock is falling, then questions start to be asked internally about, well, what are you guys doing? So I think that it's going to make it have to think much more carefully about quarterly filings, cost control, all those sorts of boring things that, you know, as a startup, you can largely ignore.
But in terms of that, if they have to prove to the bods on Wall Street, if they have to prove to us who happen to have their stock that, you know, they are moving forward, that they are increasing their revenues every quarter, et cetera, we as the users are their assets. We as the users are what they trade on. So surely they're going to start that there's the kind of expectation is that they then start to aggressively use us as those assets and use us as those pawns, or am I just being paranoid?
No, that's pretty much what the business model is. But it's also about attracting advertisers in and saying, look, we've got this vast social network. We won't tell you who people are, but if you want to advertise to the demographic of people who own a Ford Cortina, who live in Texas, who are aged between 18 and 29, and who went to such and such a high school, we can hit them. You know, we can find them. It doesn't pass out the details, rather as Google doesn't pass out its details to companies who are looking to advertise AdWords. But it can be, you know, very sure that if you have a targeted, you know, campaign, then you can hit it. So it's really about pulling more advertisers in, which I think, you know, is quite likely once they start seeing what sort of numbers Facebook actually has in terms of its turnover and its revenue. Yeah, the thing with Google back in August 2004 when it filed its S1 was that people said, wow, this company has been profitable since 2001, which, you know, was a total surprise to everyone. They didn't think that search was actually that profitable, but it was already doing $1 billion.
Well, there's a storm brewing on Twitter, the popular microblogging network, often identified as a key communication platform used by protesters and media during the political revolutions in the Middle East and Africa. The company, based in San Francisco, announced last week that it will allow individual countries to censor tweets when they don't adhere to the taste and decency, or indeed the law, decreed by that jurisdiction. To be expected, there has been a flurry of criticism against the company, which 1 year ago resolved on their blog to let the tweets flow in the face of government requests to remove offending posts. So, Charles, why the turnaround?
It isn't exactly a turnaround. It's more increasing the granularity of how Twitter does things. At the moment, or until now, if you wanted to have a tweet taken off the service, if a big organization said this tweet is breaking the law and we want it removed, then they had to apply to Twitter, which they'll still have to do, and Twitter would then consider it. And they would also put a copy of the request up on the chillingeffects.org/Twitter website.
What is Chilling Effects?
Chilling Effects is a website which is records attempts to control freedom of speech, and that's sort of, you know, that's why it exists. So Twitter sort of puts those requests up there. It doesn't say what the tweet is. It just says, you know, we've received a request for someone to remove this because it's, for example, one of the ones I looked at said this is linking to sheep music, which is copyrighted, and therefore, you know, this is breaking the DMCA. So this is more granular, and actually people are getting really worked up about this, and I think that they're getting worked up about the wrong thing. It used to be that when Twitter would censor a tweet, it would be censored across the world. Now it's censored, that is, it won't be sort of sent out to clients which say that they are in that particular country. However, it's very easy to work around, and Twitter has pretty much given people a how-to guide to work around, which is you say, no, I'm not in Egypt, actually, I'm in Tunisia.
And that's just in your settings.
That's just in your settings. I'm not in Tunisia. Actually, I'm in the USA. Yeah, okay, fine.
What have other companies who've been faced with this situation? How have they responded? Google, for example, is the elephant in the room. They went into China and then have reduced their Chinese operations. What they expressed was on ideological grounds and.
Well, Google, no, it wasn't really ideological. With Google, what happened was that they went into China and they would censor their search results as the Chinese government demanded. But when they had censored them, they would say, these search results have been censored. Click here to find out why it is censored, and it would then take them to a page saying the Chinese government demands it. When they left China, it wasn't really ideology. It was more that there was a hacking attempt against Google systems, which Sergey Brin in particular and Larry Page as well, neither of them had been greatly in favour of going into China because they didn't like the idea of self-censoring. Eric Schmidt had been much more in favour of it and said the business case was too strong. So they said, this is just absurd, let's get out. But generally, Google, for example, won't allow searches in Germany and France for things like Nazi memorabilia or extreme right-wing Nazi groups, because that's not allowed. You're not allowed to go and promote those sorts of things in those countries. It's part of the law of the land. And they have that granularity. Yahoo, eBay, they have similar granularity in those countries, again, because of the law. So this is really just fitting into that. And a lot of the outrage that's been expressed about Twitter, I think, has actually been misplaced. You know, Twitter really has told people, if you want to root around the censorship, you know, very easy, here's how to do it.
But also the way that it's removed is it says, doesn't it? It says this tweet has been removed, in the same way that on our comments in The Guardian, there's a note from the moderator that says this comment has been removed because it doesn't comply with our community standards.
Yes.
Is that how it will appear to users?
It'll roughly appear like that, except that imagine that there was a sort of an alternative, Guardian America, where you could go to and there you could see the comment. It's sort of, you know, it's like that. It's not even as if it's vanished off Twitter's database.
So what is the beef then with Twitter? Why
the
why
beef
are
is that people see
out?
The word the beef, people see the word censorship and go, oh my God, censorship, without actually reading the detail. Which I guess you could, let's blame the internets. I blame the internets and the lack of attention.
Well, finally in the news this week, in more government regulation news, the European Parliament's anti-counterfeiting trade agreement was signed by 22 countries in the Union, including the United Kingdom. And this caused a key MEP to stand down from the government. The agreement is an attempt to curb the theft of copyrighted materials. But Kadir Arif, the treaty's rapporteur, claimed that the lack of transparency or consultation with the public over this particular act, in addition to several other issues that he levied against the process leading up to the signatures, was, and I quote, a masquerade. Charles, what does ACTA say?
On the face of it, ACTA is about creating a world framework over counterfeiting intellectual property and how to make the rights of creators of property, whether it's physical property or intellectual property, be able to exert their rights in all the territories which sign up to ACTA.
That's a pretty big blanket.
That's quite a big blanket.
Yeah, because something that is under copyright in one country, I mean,
it depends on your definition. So, you know, the question is whether they're going for the highest common factor or the lowest common denominator version of copyright. And, you know, it's really complicated. It's, you know, it's a treaty. Treaties tend to be things where you have a lot of nooks and crannies and, you know, left a bit up to legislatures and, you know, but hugely complicated.
And this, the process leading up to this, I mean, what's the history of ACTA? It's been
ACTA has been ping-ponging around between. It sort of grows out of the World Intellectual Property Organization, I believe, and it's also ping-ponged around the United Nations, the G8, the G20. They've all been trying to sort of come up with this framework because there's a recognition that if you're going to have a world where physical things are made quite easily and cheaply, and the real value comes from the intellectual property, then you need a way for people to be actually able to police their intellectual property and to you know, as I say, to sort of exert their rights where they feel they've been infringed.
But we've got to a point now where people have actually signed, including the United Kingdom. Why did the UK sign?
Because they thought it was a good idea. That doesn't mean it's ratified. You have the difference here between ratified and signed. So signing the agreement doesn't necessarily mean it's actually been ratified in the country. So all these countries which have signed it, no country has ratified it. That means it hasn't gone through the legislature to be approved by those countries. So Parliament, for example, would still, in theory, debate ACTA and decide whether or not it's going to ratify it.
Now, last week, we were criticized for getting our facts wrong in the item about BlackBerry. I said that the RIM handheld was the first smartphone to market. Cubic Garden, Mystic Mobile, Sparks Road, and Paul Lomax countered the claim on Twitter with several examples, including the Nokia Communicator and the IBM Simon. The latter was a prototype with a date of 1993, and the former was released in 1996. Coincidentally, the same day as the podcast was released last week, Charles, you published a timeline of the history of the smartphone. Thank you very much for that. You started your timeline more than a decade after the Nokia Communicator was released to market in 2007. How did you define smartphone?
Well, first of all, I said Nokia, not Nokia.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
We did this last week.
Okay.
So why did
new tricks, Charles. Old dog, new tricks.
I started in 2007 with the launch of the iPhone. And the reason I did that was, there's two reasons. The first was, I was doing this for print. And print does not have unlimited amounts of space. So I couldn't have said, and in 1992, there was a phone which was able to connect to the internet. No, the reason I started with the iPhone was because it had three things which I think are really key to what we see in today's smartphone market, which is enormously bigger than anything before. It had a really good web internet browser. It had apps which you were able to launch yourself directly, and it had a multi-touch touchscreen. Now, if you look at the smartphone market now, you have the Apple iPhone, which has those three things, obviously. You have Android phones, which make more than half of the smartphone market, and they have those three aspects as well. And you have Nokia offering Windows Phone 7, which again has those three elements. The one that doesn't is RIM with the QWERTY keyboards on some of its models, although it's also introduced full touchscreen models. So, you know, RIM sort of aside, the smartphone really has developed in that way. You know, RIM is a diminishing share of the smartphone market with every hour that passes, pretty much. So that was my reasoning for starting in 2007 with the launch of the iPhone. And the other thing is, if you look back to 2007, you actually look at the volume of the smartphone market, it was about 17 million handsets per quarter, I think. Compare it now, and you're talking about something in the order of 500 million handsets per year. It's multiplied about tenfold.
Well, what do you feel is the first smartphone? If you feel that we've got something wrong, then do let us know. You can connect with us on Facebook at GuardianTW on Twitter or on guardian.co.uk/techweekly or individually to Charles and myself on Twitter. All the relevant links are on our page and on your clever MP3 players right now. And you can keep up with the news stories that we've covered on the podcast this week and more on guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, Charles, we are about to talk smart TV, so you can stand down. I think I got this one covered. A few weeks ago on the program, Charles visited the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, where one of the big stories was the launch of numerous internet-connected TVs. A new trend beginning to form? Well, in fact, it must be true. In Tech Weekly's 2011 and 2012 review preview, we mentioned this was to be a big year for IPTV. UView, a BBC, ITV, BT, and TalkTalk project to deliver TV and associated viewing apps to our screens, is due to land in 2012. And 4 weeks into the year, and there's already been action. Netflix, which is a US version of film streaming service Love Film, has launched in the UK. And just this week, Sky has announced it's to launch a new version of its catch-up subscription service over the interwebs. So, an exciting future for our viewing pleasure. Joining me to discuss it is Richard Lindsay Davis from the Digital Television Group. Richard, welcome to the pod. What is the DTG?
Well, we started in the mid-90s before digital television was launched to begin to kind of work out how, if you like, transmissions off big towers serving millions of people could interoperate properly with devices when they arrive in the home. So really, if you think of interoperability, 0% interoperability means you get no pictures and sound. 100% means you get everything exactly as it was meant to be received by you. And we're the guys that glue all that together with specifications, technology, and testing everything to make sure it works.
And this is specifically for digital television. So this is like, we are hearing about the analog switch off, and it's supposed to happen this year. So this is, you know, big, newfangled, non-cathode ray tube televisions that are connected to the web.
Yep, that's right. In Britain, we finished switch over to digital television this year. Kind of weirdly, we finished switching over to technology that was kind of defined in about 96, 97. Of course we do, because this is a very slow-moving technology. But we've added lots of bells and whistles since then, which I'll tell you about today.
Excellent. And also, Richard is joined by Gareth Clowes, a freelance technologist with a background working for, I believe, the BBC and UView. Tell me a little bit about UView, Gareth.
Well, some years ago, Alex, the broadcasters realised that internet-connected TVs and internet-connected set-top boxes were going to become a big thing, and people like the BBC were quite keen to get the iPlayer on as many screens as they could. And one of the risks they saw could occur would be that every different platform would have its own standard for building applications, and so.
And when you say different platform, do you mean the different channels, or do you mean the different devices?
I mean the different devices or the different manufacturers. So, if you were going to write a version of iPlayer, you might have to write it for the TV brand A. And if another TV set came along and said, we're internet connected, you might have to write another version of iPlayer. And the broadcasters just saw that that could be unsustainable. As developers, they didn't want to have to develop a new version of a service for every new device that came along that they wanted to be on.
So this is specifically British broadcasters, though. So this was Channel 4, BBC, ITV, Sky, et cetera, et cetera. And is this a model that's being repeated globally? Where does the UK stand in terms of its forward thinking for this kind of output?
Well, in terms of broadcasters who normally compete working together, the UK actually stands very well through organisations like the DTG. But in comparison to some other markets, they sit very uneasily alongside each other. And so some of the very basic things that we expect to have, like a list of what's on the TV now and what's on next, some countries have launched without that because their broadcasters are so fiercely competitive. They can't see the benefit in coming together to launch a service that works for consumers.
Richard, tell me a little bit about the different standards and how manufacturers of the televisions that are coming into our homes, that are being nailed onto our walls, how standards are starting to be developed so that we have content from whether it's a UView consortium or different channels can actually be played across the different systems.
We've applied those same rules that with broadcast television, one size has to fit all. You can't interrogate the TV and say, hey, which TV are you? I'll send you that version. And we've applied those rules to internet-connected televisions to make sure that one size fits all again. And the benefits of that are you can innovate to very advanced, complex services, which is good for the consumer.
What kinds of complex services are we talking about? Are these some of the things, Gareth, that you're involved in terms of developing apps or being involved in thinking about the different types of things that people can do on their television sets?
I mean, yeah, that's one thing I've been thinking a lot about because I think people forget that TV is very much a lean-back experience. It's quite a horrible phrase, but when you come home, you sit down on your sofa and you're largely turning the TV on to turn your brain off. We've been able to order pizza on our TV in 1998. It didn't work then.
I remember that. Oh, yeah. That was quite an exciting story, wasn't it?
Yeah, and my connected TV has a Twitter client. I've sent one tweet on it that said, this is the most awkward tweet I've ever sent.
Well, exactly, because how on earth would you be doing it? It's not as if you've got a QWERTY
keyboard.
You're
back to multitap. It's the days of the 90s. And the big thing at the moment is that anyone who is using a connected TV as a connected TV has probably got an iPad or a smartphone in their hand already. And those devices make a lot more sense for the kind of interaction type things, or maybe second screens when you are looking at the tweets that are coming alongside the program that you're watching.
And those I've heard them described as companion screens. So are things like connected TVs and the apps that are portended, these sort of foreshadowed apps that we may be able to access via our connected TVs, Are these devices that we're putting onto our walls a response to the fact that we have, or broadcasters have, threats, or even manufacturers have threats from companion screens?
I think what's going to happen is that companion screens are going to remain companion screens. The main people who are going to be writing apps for connected TVs are going to be people with lots of video content. So I have iPlayer on my laptop and I have iPlayer on my TV. And if I'm using it on my TV, I can do other things at the same time and I can tune in and out of it by looking at my TV rather than like trying to find whatever tab it was I've squirreled iPlayer away on my browser. They're great for video applications, but for things that are the companion type things, that's going to stay on people's smartphones or their tablets. Where I think there is room for innovation is when people start having apps that are running on their handheld devices that are then interacting with the TV. So I can imagine that if you're in a family and you're playing some game where you've got one round and everyone's got 60 seconds to find however many words they can or whatever, at the end of the round, the TV then flashes up what everyone's scores are and so can unify people again. But generally, people who are going to be writing apps for TV are people who have video content because TV's primarily about watching.
That simply sounds like it's a monitor, Richard. I mean, as I mentioned, I don't have a television. I don't see the need because there is video on demand or, I pick and choose. I use my large monitor that's on my wall as if it's an entertainment device for my entertainment, if and when. So why on earth should I bother with a connected television?
Let me throw a couple of simple stats at you. Ridiculously, in the UK, people at the moment buy around 9.5 million televisions every year. And we only have 24.5 million TV households.
Is that, though, I'm going to come back on that, actually. Is that not, though, because we've been told that we're about to do a digital switchover and we have to buy a new kind of television?
The television market in the UK in the mid-90s at around 5.5 million a year. Over the last so many years, we've now developed to a TV market that at its peak was 9 million. And I guess it'll drop off a bit. But because of the price erosion, the low cost of televisions and you know, beautiful looking new features come in all the time, actually the replacement cycle of TV is much faster than it ever was. People have more TVs. So you know, I think it's going to hold up reasonably well. So just run with me on this. So around 9.5 million TVs being sold into the UK. You're right. Some people will be throwing stuff up there from their smart devices, their laptops, whatever that might be. But if you look at connected television, so TVs connected to the internet, the main used feature on those televisions, 65% of people say the main used feature is to catch up on broadcast television. So still, to a lot of households, a lot of homes, and it'll probably decline, it'll probably change, who knows what the dynamics will be, but still to a lot of households, they're actually using internet television or connected television, smart TV, to catch up on broadcast television. Now, that doesn't exclude the additional exciting innovations that might be going on. Things like the second screen stuff we were just talking about, the companion screen stuff, the play-along stuff, whatever that might be, the information base, the infotainment, are we still allowed to use that word,
dear
stuff?
Oh, God, whatever, get out of the studio.
All that, I'm going. But all that stuff will, of course, continue and you know, add to the great experience that we have on TV. But we can't get away from the fact that today, as things stand, people are using the television still for television as well as these additional things.
And so ultimately the idea that broadcast is not dead is played out in these, in your stats. Except, of course, broadcast is now on demand, or it's increasingly on demand, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, probably a better way to phrase it is TV's not dead. We kind of like TV. Matters less how you get it, I think, is the message.
But people are actually watching more TV, and a recent report by Deloitte showed they're actually watching more live TV. So even though they're watching more on demand, they are also watching more live. So, yeah, TV is very much not dead.
Yeah, weirdly, just to back that up, that more public service broadcast television is watched on recorded devices, so Sky Plus, Review Plus, etc. in the UK.
Or good old VHS.
Or VHS on recorded devices than if you don't have a recorded device. If you go to connected, you watch even more public service broadcast TV. So the kind of appetite for TV hasn't gone away. Doesn't mean to say there's not an insatiable appetite for lots of other stuff too.
What types of things have you drawn on from that experience and what it was that people were thinking about so that you now know what it is that people will want to consume and what it is that broadcasters will want to deliver?
I think the goal of the main use of connected TV will be for broadcasters and people with video to make their video as easily available when people want it as they can.
Is this including things like YouTube?
So YouTube, or if you look on the Apple TV, there's the Wall Street Journal. Everyone who's got video content is trying to get them onto as many easy-to-use screens as possible.
Apple TV and Google TV are obviously in the pipeline as well. They're in the background, at least. Are these manufacturers, or rather, are these software developers or hardware developers, are they going to take over? Or, you know, should Samsung and Sony and Panasonic and all the other manufacturers start to freak out because these other devices know what it is that people want to do online?
I think we're potentially going to enter a format war that we haven't seen before. And rather than just VHS versus Betamax, we're potentially going to have four or five players as the dominant standard for connected TV devices starts to appear.
How, Richard, then, does the DTG recommend all of these negotiate these standards? How do you ensure, or how do you propose that you're, when dealing with a US company like Apple or like a Google who are developing these systems, how do you try and create standards for the British market? You know, there's this really interesting sort of global positioning thing that's going on at the minute, isn't there?
Yeah, and actually, weirdly, Apple have been pretty supportive of some standardization already. So you know, they don't go it alone completely. But if you think of Apple TV and Google TV's success so far in the UK, you know, not a massive market share. And so, you know, I think it's yet to play out. And it'll still come down to who has the content you want, when it's available, and how that works for you. So, you know, I think content rights play into this. I think that that's very, very important. But if you wind forward to kind of what does all this mean long term? So what does all this mean long term? So we can get more TV, we can get more video, we can get more apps, we can do more things on multiple devices. That's really exciting. What happens to our TV? Well, our TVs are increasingly becoming 3D. They're increasingly becoming, I think at some point, what we call auto-stereoscopic TV, which means TV without the spectacles, TV without glasses. And for TV without glasses, you need a camera built into the TV. So it looks at you while you're looking at the TV to support where you are in the room, which opens it up to Skype and much more interaction, and even targeting who's in the room, how tall they are, what they look like, with face recognition.
Telescreen, 1984.
Yeah. So actually, you know, technology's never, ever done. The important thing about standardization is to make sure that there's a foundation level of continued service, at least for the period of the warranty of the product you've bought. So if you buy a TV in the UK, you're quite likely to get a five-year warranty. During those 5 years, apps will come and go, services will come and go, either from business failure or because they'll just expire, because people won't be using them. But you'll still want your core of television to carry on working. So one of our jobs is to ensure that, A, there's enough of a deployed market for people to launch exciting services to. You're not going to need to launch services to a few people. You want millions of people, the kind of scales of television. And secondly, to protect consumers, to make sure that some of those core services are here to stay.
Thank you very much, Richard and Gareth. You can find out more about Connected TV at guardian.co.uk/technology. Well, that's it for this week's podcast. Many thanks to our guests, Richard and Gareth, and thank you, Charles, for doing your time in the studio. A special thanks this week to producer Scott, who has been our fearless leader since the beginning of the podcast in 2007, but is leaving us for pastures anew. We will miss you. And actually, I've got a few words that we had recorded from what Scott likes to call the dream team. So if you just have a little listen, Scott, this one's for you.
Hello, or actually, goodbye. Scott, you've made such a fantastic difference to all of our lives through doing all this work on the Tech Podcast. We're going to miss you so much, and we really hope that we'll see you again.
Here are three facts about Scott. One of them is false. Number one, if Scott were to appear on Mastermind, his specialist subject would be obscure and terrible dance music. Two, Scott has enjoyed the sweaty embrace of Chris Evans and Chris Moyles, which in the radio industry is known as eating a sweaty ginger breakfast sandwich. And three, Scott Corley is one of the few people who eats more chocolate and pizza than I do, yet disgustingly, he remains about a quarter of the size. So which is the odd one out? Well, that's a trick question. They're all true. And here's another true fact. He will be missed. So for all those times we traipsed around in the rain to do interviews, and all those days when you kept me sane while I phoned into the studio from under a pile of coats in my wardrobe, Scott, I salute you.
Scott leaving is a bit like losing a wife. He does all this amazing organisation and hard work and isn't really appreciated for it. I'm very pleased he'll be able to spend more time with Reggie, who will be able to take on longer walks. That is a dog. But also, on a serious note, I've worked all over the country with Scott. Edinburgh, Dublin, Bristol, Newcastle, loads of places. I've worked with him every week for nearly 5 years now, and I'm truly sad that he's going to be leaving. Good luck, Scott, and stay in touch. And we'll see you on the Twitters.
That was Charles Arthur, Bobby Johnson, and Jemima Kish. And Scott, it's true, you will be missed. A few tears will be shed as you leave to produce your radio programmes and documentaries.
Thank you very much, Alex. Jemima made it sound like we were kind of in a rock band or something, travelling the country.
It's sort of what it is, isn't it?
It is. It's the dream team.
It's not been that for a few years. Thank you very much. I will miss you all. It's been nice working with you. And thank you very much. Yes, yeah. Good luck with
that. Say that with sincerity, Scott. Thank you, producer Scott. Now, the rest of us will be back next week on Tuesday with the next episode of Tech Weekly. I'm Alex Kratosky, and this one's for you, Scott. See you next Tuesday.
Hey!
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.